This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
MSW Media.
So, Renato, now that Judge Chutkan has thrown Trump's absolute immunity claim out the window, does this mean that he'll be going to trial in March?
It's complicated. I'm Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a legal analyst.
And I'm Asha Rangappa. I teach national security law at Yale University. I'm a former FBI special agent, and I'm a legal contributor for ABC News.
And we're here to help you understand topics that can't be boiled down into a soundbite or a tweet.
So we had a double whammy last week, or a double bench slap, as...
As I like to say.
So in the same day, basically, the Trump's claim of absolute immunity was rejected both by the D.C. Court of Appeals with regard to the civil lawsuits that had been filed against him for January 6th about injuries that resulted from the riots. And by the district court, Judge Tanya Chutkan, hours later in his criminal case for January 6th. And this was kind of, you know, his big claim, and we can unpack it, that pretty much was trying to argue that if the president does it, it's legal. To paraphrase Richard Nixon.
Yes.
So... yeah, I mean, I guess we can unpack what you said. I thought both of the opinions, I thought were very well written. And Judge Chutkan's definitely flowed from the D.C. Circuit's reasoning. But they are slightly different, right? So both Trump's claim was trying to utilize a Nixon-era Supreme Court precedent that stated, it was Nixon versus Fitzgerald, which was brought by an employee whose position, government employee whose position was terminated after he gave unfavorable testimony to Congress, I guess, about Nixon. And he claimed, I guess, that he was being retaliated against or something like that. And basically, the court in that case says that the president is immune from civil suits for acts that he undertakes that are within the outer perimeter of his presidential duties. And that, you know, those presidential duties don't have to necessarily be what is only explicitly laid out in Article 2, but things that are a natural extension of them or that fall into kind of a, I guess, a reasonable gray zone of conduct, right, that would come. And I think the policy reason behind this is that presidents make tons of decisions and you don't want them to be constrained in making decisions because they are afraid that if they do what is best in their opinion for the country in the exercise of the presidential duties, that as soon as they leave office, they're going to be faced with a flood of lawsuits. I mean, I think it was kind of a public policy reasoning is really what this is comes down to.
Right. I mean, you kind of have to have that. You don't want a situation where the president is trying to decide whether to bomb some missile site and is thinking about potential lawsuit, right? He has to wheel in his lawyers or worry about, you know, potential civil suits. So in that context, it makes a perfect sense, I would say, in that particular context.
Yes. But the D.C. Circuit then says what Trump was doing on January 6th was not in the outer perimeter of his presidential duties. This was clearly activity that he was undertaking in his personal capacity, like running for re-election. And therefore, it was not entitled to get the kind of immunity that the court articulated in Nixon versus Fitzgerald.
That's right. And I think you can understand why that's the case as well, because ultimately, at the end of the day, what Donald Trump was doing, or at least what he's alleged to be doing in these civil complaints, is that he's essentially conspiring to undermine the operations of the United States government and the peaceful transfer of power in the United States government. Now, of course, Trump's going to have his own version of that, right, where he's just giving a peaceful speech. And, you know, presidents all the time give speeches about all sorts of things, and they should be immunized for that. Like, let's say the Challenger blows up and Reagan gives a speech. But obviously, it's a very different circumstance. It's understandable that the D.C. Circuit came to where they're at.
Right. And I would say that at least in that case, he was trying to cite a precedent that at least was in the general context, the similar context, because he was trying to apply a doctrine that was promulgated in the course of a civil case, in the course of another civil case that was being brought against him. And the question was whether, you know, these actions fell within this outer perimeter. Now, in the January 6th criminal case, what he was doing was trying to extrapolate from that same case, that Nixon versus Fitzgerald, but into the criminal context. So basically, he was making the same argument, but then also saying, if the president is immune from criminal liability for acts that are undertaken, and he argued that his actions were in this outer perimeter of his presidential duties. But again, this was taking it even a step further by saying, and you can't even prosecute me criminally.
Right. Which is obviously a bridge much further, right? I was going to use the analogy, a bridge too far. But yes, and Tanya Chutkin, I think very...
deftly.
Definitely gave it the back of her hand.
Eloquently,
so to speak, right?
Yeah. She was basically like talk to the hand. You know, I think she had many different good points, and I summarized the main ones that stood out to me as being very well stated and persuasive in my Substack. The first one was kind of about the extension of the Nixon versus Fitzgerald doctrine into the criminal realm. And what she says is that policy reason that we talked about, the prospect of chilling the president in the exercise of his official duties out of fear of future liability, was not really something that would happen in the criminal context. So she states, for example, it's not like in the civil context where you said dropping a bomb somewhere, right? Like this is, you know, your mental state is I'm, you know, trying to exercise my war powers and, you know, you're not really understanding or maybe thinking about the consequences of that might potentially create civil liability. What she says is in the criminal context, you have to have like a state of mind. There is a certain amount of intentionality that is required to be a crime. You have to have a mens rea, right? A particular state of mind for it to be a crime, in addition to the action that you do. And this is not something that would just happen, you know, inadvertently or, you know, just casually in the exercise of a president in the exercise of his duties. So that, you know, there's no real prospect that being held criminally liable would realistically chill a president in doing anything that was actually within the scope of his presidential duties.
Yeah, I think that's it is persuasive. I'll say if I was, and I don't represent Trump, not interested, but if I was on the other side of that, right, if I was on the Trump lawyer, I would say, well, look, you can imagine situations where a president, let's say it's Waco or something, you know, a president is making decisions about that are controversial. And that you could, you know, you could imagine a situation where a runaway local prosecutor is like, hey, I'm going to bring charges because of this wrongful, you know, these sort of wrongful actions that were ordered by the president, where the president's just trying to keep people safe. But I think as it's fair to say that the when we're talking about you called it, I think earlier, Asha, policy argument, and the policy mm-hmm. arguments really they weigh differently in these two circumstances, because in civil cases it's very easy to imagine civil lawsuits being filed by all sorts of people for all sorts of reasons related to all sorts of things, and it's one of the reasons why there's so many lawyers around is that they not only are needed to defend those suits but to dream them up. But in the criminal context, it's much more the idea that a president would be charged, particularly while in office, but even shortly thereafter, it's much more remote. In fact, it's never happened in our history until Donald Trump became president.
Yeah, and I think that's fair what you said about the counter arguments. I'm trying to think of a hypothetical, which I think could be, for example, say a 9/11 type scenario, mm-hmm. right? You have hijackers who are commandeered a plane and they are, you know, flying it directly to the White House. The president decides to have our military fighter jets shoot it down, right? Would that be murder? Could he be prosecuted for murder? I mean, I think that's probably like the closest you could get to a hypothetical where criminal liability could be like contemplated. But even then, right, think about what you'd have to prove for the mental state, right? And right. you would never be able to show that the president did that in order to kill the people on the plane, as opposed to prevent, you know, something else. My point is that even there, I think it would be a complex case. And as you said, it would be so rare. And what she also says is, and by the way, you know, at the end of the day, if charges were brought, it could be brought by one entity. She's talking only in the federal context right now. It would be brought by the Department of Justice. It's not like the civil context where you can be sued by countless number of people. And, you know, what she says is that on top of that, there are so many safeguards in our criminal justice system to protect the defendant. So, you know, in that case, in the case of like shooting down the airliner, you know, you would need an attorney general who decides that this is, you know, a murder case and we're going to actually like pursue a prosecution. Then, you know, you would need a grand jury to indict this person. Then you'd need to go through a trial. You need to convince a jury. And so what she says is those same policy concerns where, you know, you have a president leave office and it's just going to be, you know, overrun with, you know, these being tied up in court is simply not a realistic prospect in the criminal context.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the work that's being done there is by saying it's federal and not state. I mean, I think we can imagine local prosecutors in West Virginia or Mississippi deciding that prosecuting Joe Biden would be good for their electoral prospects or whatever they're trying to accomplish, their Fox News appearances, Newsmax appearances, and deciding that that's a good idea. I will say that while courts often talk about all the rights and protections that are afforded defendants, and there are, and they are important, the government has a tremendous amount of weight, and the balance is much more stacked against defendants than you might imagine. But yes, in the context of a president and a former president, the scales are balanced differently, shall we say, as many of our listeners, to their chagrin, at times. So I agree with that, and I think the thing with Trump and these arguments is they're not being made in a manner that is where there's a lot of nuance, or they're trying to present sort of outer limits because they need to get to where they want to go. They need such broad sweeping immunity that they're not making it. They're not making these challenging decisions for Judge Chutkan, in my opinion.
Right. She then goes on to balance against, you know, the policy issue that we just talked about, the public's interest in allowing the criminal prosecution. And what she says is the public interest in seeing a commission of a crime be, you know, prosecuted is significant. And here she actually invokes another Nixon era case, United States versus Nixon. And she makes here, this is something that I had not thought about, but I think it's a really good one. It is a separation of powers argument where she says, look, this conduct is so reprehensible that Congress decided to criminalize it. You know, they didn't just make only civil liability. They said that doing this is a crime. You know, conspiring to deprive people of rights is a crime. Obstructing Congress is a crime. And so she said, creating some kind of absolute immunity for the president would impinge on separation of powers, which is, you know, Congress's prerogative to make laws, criminalize laws, the judiciary's prerogative. Duty to, enforce those, or to, I guess, adjudicate those laws in the administration of justice. So I thought the separation of powers argument was pretty persuasive. And then in any case, by the by, she says, none of this was in the outer perimeter of your presidential duties anyway, because this was all happening in your personal capacity. And what I love to hear is she actually cites to Trump's own filing in the Supreme Court in the Pennsylvania case, where it says, like in the opening paragraph, I'm filing this in my personal capacity. So basically she is like, there you go.
Which is it, right? Yeah, pick a side.
Yeah, which is it? Yeah. So I thought all of that was good. And I don't know that we need to go into some of his more specious claims, which were things like, you know, that his acquittal during impeachment meant that he couldn't be criminally indicted because of the language of the Constitution and double jeopardy. It was all very, to me, those seem like Mickey Mouse arguments. I mean, I can see why his lawyers were making them, but like,
yeah, whatever. We disagreed about those in the past. I mean, I will say, just as somebody practices federal criminal law a lot, those are, it's to have an actual novel argument that there's no existing law on is generally fantastic for the defendant. But I get your point. They're not compelling when you hear them and when you hear them described, but I can understand why he's making them. There's no law on the point, so they're totally novel.
Well, let me go ahead and explain the
I've got her worked up, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, well, the impeachment one was so dumb. It was that because the impeachment clause says that, you know, in the case of being convicted in an impeachment proceeding, an impeachment trial, the punishment can go no farther than removal from office and a prohibition from holding public office. In other words, those are the two penalties. However, that doesn't preclude being prosecuted. And what they say is they're trying to kind of read some corollary into that by saying, so if you're not removed or there's no penalty, you're not convicted, then you can't be prosecuted.
Right, it's like double jeopardy.
After impeachment. It's like, well, the double jeopardy argument is separate. They were actually making a textual argument, but it's a reading. It's kind of it was just legal sophistry. It was like reading kind of, it's like playing a record backwards to hear, you know, the devil talking or something that. Like it made no sense. You know, it was a smart argument for dumb people.
Yeah. It's one of these things. I hear what you're saying. It's just that I'll just say this as somebody who's been in and around the criminal justice system for decades now. So many of the arguments made by defendants are much worse than that. Like there's not sufficient evidence of my conviction, even though I confessed. And the standard of review is such that like no rational juror could have found me guilty. You know, those sort of things. Here it's like de novo review. there's no presumption that he's wrong. There's no law on the point. It's like totally novel. At least there's like a plausible idea that this could be an argument. But I hear what you're saying. I'm just trying to give our listeners a perspective.
Like if it was an SAT reading comprehension passage, his interpretation of that passage would be wrong.
It just
was not a logical inference that you could make from the reading of that particular clause. You know, maybe the double jeopardy thing, I don't know, but like that particular one, and she goes through and she parses it and she says, no,
right,
like, let's look at the structure
seriously
of this sentence here and how it works. Yeah. Anyway. So, but here's the interesting thing is that this is not necessarily the end of the story, which is that, I mean, procedurally, there's a few more steps, right? And one is that he can appeal this ruling. He's probably not, given the D.C. Circuit's ruling in the civil case, I mean, it's going to be a non-starter there, but then he can kick it up to the Supreme Court.
That's right. And I'll just say one thing, I'll just take a step back. I mean, I'm going back and forth with you about some of the details, but just to take a step back here for a minute, it's apparent to me that Judge Chutkan understood how weighty her rulings were here. I think she understood that these rulings would ultimately be reviewed, not just by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, but by the United States Supreme Court. And they'd be the most important decisions that she would make in her career. So it was apparent to me from reading them, it was apparent how much care that she put into them.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And so that's one thing I'll just say. The second is to take another step back. You know, typically speaking, if you have a motion to dismiss, you know, usually what's called an interlocutory appeal, an appeal before the case is over, is not favored and is rarely unavailable to a defendant in a criminal case. Typically, you make a motion to dismiss, it's denied, and okay, now you got to go to trial. and that's basically the only leverage, I should say, that the defense has is saying, we're going to go to trial and win. In this case, though, essentially the arguments that Trump's making not only are novel, but they're ones that would essentially mean that he wouldn't, if he's right, he wouldn't be standing trial at all. And so I think they're given all the circumstances, I think there's a reasonable chance that these are going to be, there will be an interlocutory appeal. And I'll go a step further and say, I think that's why he made them. I think the real goal here was not that, no, I don't think they had any hope that Tanya Chutkan was going to agree with them for sure. And I think they're even in front of the Supreme Court, I bet that his team is telling him that our chances are uphill at best. But I think the goal here is to try to run out some clock and get this in front of the Supreme Court, because it wouldn't be a shocker for the Supreme Court to ultimately take this and potentially create enough delay that it could impact the timing of this trial past the, not only past the March, but potentially past the election.
I mean, they can help him kick the can. I'm not sure on the merits what they would do with it, though. One interesting thing is that, you know, Chutkan's opinion repeatedly cites to the Clinton v. Jones case, which talks about how purely private conduct is basically fair game for civil liability and definitely for criminal liability. Guess who was, you know, a major lawyer down when we were looking at the whole Clinton Jones thing? Justice Kavanaugh. I would have to say it would
Indeed.
Be so rich for him to suddenly find that all of these things are, you know, in the outer perimeter when they conveniently were not 21 years ago.
Oh, I agree. I think he's going to lose in the Supreme Court on these points. I think the question is just, I mean, I think there's two questions. One, will he get any votes? What votes will he get?
Thomas.
Will he get Alito and Thomas and no others? Right. But secondly, will they work with him on the timing? In other words, you can imagine a sort of, you know, Pyrrhic victory for Jack Smith and team, or the United States of America. Let's put it this way, since that's who they represent, the United States. You know, where the United States wins its point in court because they prevailed at the Supreme Court.
About it.
But it's too late. Yes.
Yeah.
And that's why it is, my friends, is it is complicated. Yes.
When is it too late? I guess that's another question that I haven't really heard anyone talk with specificity about, because, you know, the DOJ's 90-day rule is really about the investigative phase, I think.
Yeah, when right? charges
taking overt
brought.
Steps. Yeah. But in a case like this, where it's already rolling through the justice system, do you think they have until January 2024?
Boy, I mean, I have to say, Asha, this is totally, I mean, just so everyone listening understands, it's totally unprecedented. There's no law on this. There's no right answer here. Where, and what I mean by right answer, there may be a right answer in terms of what's the right thing to do. But I mean, what, there's no answer that we could look up in some book that's going to tell you the answer to this. And I think the challenge here is that having a criminal trial, let's say 2 months before the election, if Trump is in fact the Republican nominee, is going to be a total circus and incredibly disruptive, right? Where, you know, you've got Biden going from battleground state to battleground state at rallies, and Trump, you know, on trial and either deciding I'm going to skip the trial because I need to run for president and that this is a sham, and that's what he tells his supporters, or, and they're trying to imprison me so I can't be your choice, or he's sitting there in trial and he argues that, you know, uses that as sort of a prop to say they're trying to silence me, they're trying to put me away so you can't vote for me, don't listen to them. It feeds into his BS about the whole system being against him and is going to work to subvert public confidence in our judicial system and our criminal justice system, which is just absolutely unfortunate.
Unfortunately, it's, you know, a Scylla and Charybdis kind of situation, because, you know, the other option is, what do? Just like put it off, and then what if he wins and what happens then? I mean, in other words, if you're really treating him like any other person, then I would say the argument is that you simply proceed. And I mean, it's his choice to run for president, you know?
There's a very good chance, I'd say one way or the other, that this proceeds quickly enough that there can be a trial in a reasonable amount of time before the election. And if that is not the case, if we're sitting here in June or July and we're trying to figure out, can we rush in a trial before the election? I really think that Merrick Garland's decision making in the early years of the Biden presidency.
I was just about to say this.
Fateful.
It will be, I mean, that will have been a fateful decision.
Absolutely fateful.
To basically sit on his ass for 18 months. I'm sorry. It really makes me mad, because I was convinced that they were investigating, and during that whole time, I was like, FBI has to be investigating. Like, there was a crime committed, like, literally in front of millions of people on television. And to kind of come to the realization a year and a half later that, nope, they hadn't been investigating or doing anything. When did he appoint Jack Smith? Was it December of last year?
Yeah, something around that time. It's really focused on Mar-a-Lago, right?
It was December of last year. December of last year. And just think about how quickly he brought those charges. Imagine if Merrick Garland had appointed a special counsel immediately after he had been confirmed and just said.
And it wasn't a crazy idea.
It was not a crazy idea. We were talking about this. You and I were tweeting about this all the time.
I wrote a column in Politico before Biden was inaugurated saying the right choice for Biden is to appoint a special counsel to go through all the Trump stuff, everything that happened that we knew about at the time, this before January 6th happened, saying go through the Mueller report, go through all this Hatch Act stuff, go through everything, have a special counsel come out with a report and say, here's everything that Trump did during his presidency, and here's why I'm not prosecuting almost all of it. And if he is prosecuting or she's prosecuting anything, she can say, you know, I'm prosecuting this one piece of what he did, and here's why. And that's what should have happened from day one. They should have had a special counsel taking a look at what happened during the Trump presidency. So yeah, it's very, very, very hard.
Yeah, and Merrick Garland was not the one who saved the day. It was Liz Cheney. Like, imagine if you could go back in time to your, like, you know, 2005 self and be like, Liz Cheney is going to be the one trying to save democracy in 19 years. You're going to be like, what are you talking about? Like,
I know.
Anyway.
Crazy.
It's just insane. I can't deal.
Well, at the time, Donald Trump was like trying to hawk like Trump steaks on Celebrity Apprentice. So that would have really surprised. I mean, tell me that would have really surprised me. Okay. I mean, his big choice was like, you know, am I going to fire Meatloaf or am I going to fire, whatever. I forget who he had. It was just like, it was absurd, right? It was like a Gary Busey or something.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it was like, what a show.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where Trump was. And now here he is trying literally inciting people to attack our capital and destroy the peaceful transfer of power and everything else.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
So it's Tuesday, the 5th. We just had some breaking news. I was on CNN like a half hour before we started recording, where Jack Smith has sort of showed some of his cards regarding the evidence that he's going to be putting forward to trial.
I like it when Jack Smith shows his cards.
Well, it's interesting when things, you know, this is where stuff, or I'm told I can swear in this podcast. It's starting to get real, okay? Because you know you're getting close to a criminal trial where the prosecution is starting to say, okay, here's what our evidence is going to look like. And what Jack Smith is saying now is, look, we're going to introduce evidence. One big piece is we're going to introduce evidence that Trump is essentially praising and supporting and lifting up the insurrectionists. After January 6th, essentially, you know, he's calling them patriots. He's suggesting he's going to pardon them and things along those lines. Very interesting. Ordinarily, by the way, just to make sure our listeners understand, that would ordinarily be irrelevant under the federal rules of evidence. In other words, usually if you commit a crime, let's say I shoot somebody, and then you're like, well, I want to introduce all this evidence of what, you know, what he did and said much later. Usually it's like, well, why does that matter? Right? What matters is what you're doing and the crime that occurred on that day. But of course, Trump's defense here is going to be, I had nothing. I had no idea these people were going to attack the Capitol. I was just giving a speech and giving my thoughts and my ideas, my you know, political views or my views on this, what was going on at the Capitol. I was shocked and abhorred that people were going to go and attack police officers. But of course, his later statements reveal his intent. and suggest that, in fact, he was conspiring with those people. That's going to be Jack Smith's argument. I think it's one that is being, it's evidence that's being offered in large part because of the potential defense that Jack Smith anticipates Trump is going to have at trial.
Yeah, that he did not intend for that to happen, like that his state of mind was not, again, going back to that criminal state of mind. And it mirrors, I think, the argument that the House lawyers made in the impeachment proceedings, where they pointed to his action, to Trump's actions after the insurrection started, as evidence of, you know, him wanting to see that violence. And of course, they were working on a much short, you know, they didn't have as much evidence at that time. I'm sure Jack Smith has more. And also, he is, by the way, looking, going to be bringing in, it sounds like, stuff from before January 6th. Like, he's going to bring in the statement from the 2020 presidential debate where he tells the Proud, he says, you know, I'm telling the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by. So as I think kind of building this picture that he was kind of already thinking about this. And there's also, I'm sure, I know that there is some timing with regard to his be there and be wild tweet in December. And some of the stuff that was going on behind the scenes with, you know, Sidney Powell and all of them when they decided that they were going to, when he rejects other, the more reasonable people, I use that term loosely, around him who say, look, it's over. And he says no and decides to go with the Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs people. And it is mirrored in what he says publicly to his followers.
Yeah. No, I think just in terms of the chances of this evidence getting admitted, I think Judge Shutkin's going to let it in. And so the usual, I really think the only issue here is this is not, these aren't like wrongful acts in the sense that expressing an opinion that these people are patriots is not in and of itself like a crime or something like that. And so the question of whether this gets in, I mean, these are statements by Trump, so they're generally going to be admissible as long as they're relevant. I've explained to you why the prosecution believes they're relevant. And so then the only issue is, are they unfairly prejudicial? And is the probative value of those statements substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice? And I say unfairly prejudicial. It's a word that often gets dropped out when people are arguing about these evidentiary points. But the reason I say that is that most probative evidence is prejudicial in some regard. I mean, in other words, it's not going to make Trump look good that he's calling these people who are like beating cops upside the head as patriots and, you know, praising them and offering to pardon them or suggesting he's going to pardon them. But the question is whether it's unfair, prejudice, and I don't expect that Judge Shutkin is going to find that. She might give some instruction to caution the jury about how they're supposed to use this evidence, but I expect it's going to come in. I expect it's going to be very powerful. Because it really boxes him in. I mean, I think Trump, in many ways, we've talked in prior episodes, Asha, about how he makes his attorney's life more difficult. You know, one of the challenges, and I'll say this as somebody who has, you know, after a lengthy career as a federal prosecutor, have spent many years as a criminal defense attorney, one of the challenges is what I'll call client management. And, you have clients who want to do crazy things. That's how they ended up charged with crimes. And Trump is really making his attorney's life very difficult here because these statements, which I understand have some value to him politically, make it very, very hard for them to come out and try to say, like, he had no idea. He's so shocked. He's so abhorred, right? If you were somebody who's like, I'm abhorred by what happened here. That's how so many of the Republican congressmen and Republican senators, that's their statement. Like, oh, you know, we're shocked that this happened. Well, like, he can't do that.
Yeah. And just, you know, this is, I think that it is definitely relevant for Jack Smith because it goes to the conspiracy, mm-hmm. right? The conspiracy against rights is about depriving people in the exercise of their rights through intimidation and violence. And, you know, if after the fact you're like, good job, thanks for doing that, you know, it's so unfair that you got prosecuted, then when they engaged in that very violence and intimidation, it certainly seems like a post hoc endorsement of it. So, I mean, it's hard to then, you know, make the argument that it was an unintended consequence of what you wanted.
Indeed. It really boxes out some of his key defense arguments. And so that's often why the prosecution introduces evidence. They try to anticipate defense arguments. They try to box them out. I think they're putting Trump's team in a tough spot.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Are you struggling to lower your bad LDL cholesterol, even though you may be taking a statin, swapping steaks for salads, and exercising while listening to this podcast? Ask your doctor if Repatha Evolocumab is right for you. With Repatha, you can dramatically reduce bad cholesterol and the risk of another heart attack while enjoying life too, because you're human. And with convenient self-administration, you can take Repatha in the comfort of your own home. Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Repatha can cause serious allergic reactions. Signs include trouble breathing or swallowing, or swelling of the face. Most common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. Visit Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA. Talk to your doctor today about Repatha.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
So before we go, we're a week out after Thanksgiving. We're heading into the holidays, and it's that time of year. It's getting dark at here, literally at 4:30, which makes me want to go home and go to sleep. Harder to be active. And I don't know about you, but the struggle is real.
The struggle is.
With the
I was gonna say, well, we have to be specific because there are many struggles when it comes to Christmas.
No, I seriously, Renato, I feel like a busted can of biscuit dough. You know, when you open a can, it's like it kind of spills out. Like that's what I feel like right now.
Well, I have been, as you know, I've been under the weather for the last week, so I'm a little bit sedentary, and I've been not eating as well because I've been focused on just getting well. But for me, weight loss has been a struggle my entire life. When I was a kid, I ate way too much. We ate bad foods. I was never taught what to eat well. Like we just ate. My mom is an amazing cook, and she made unbelievable food constantly all the time. And we had unlimited cookies and pop everywhere. So for me, I weigh myself every day and work out multiple times a week, go to personal trainer just to stay at a normal weight.
Yeah. I think crazy. And I just feel like it's just harder now. I mean, I don't know. Like, I feel like I work out, I don't eat that poorly. But it's just not the way it was. And I heard about something called 70-day hard. Have you ever heard of this?
Yeah. What is
it's
that?
It's like this guy who got really fed up, I guess, with his whole situation. And so he came up with his, like, the things that he was promising to do every day. And I think it's like, you know, take a picture, work out twice a day. At least one of them has to be outside. Get on a diet, like whatever eating plan you want, like just pick one and stick to it. I think like drink like 2 gallons of water or something like that. And read like 10 pages or a chapter in a book every day. So I am...
It doesn't fit with the rest, but okay.
I think it was like kind of like getting into good habits. So I'm trying to do a version. We can call it 40-day sort of hard-ish.
40 days.
Not soft.
40 days. not soft.
So if my 40 days not soft, I am trying to meditate, walk 10,000 steps a day, get 40 zone minutes on my Fitbit each day, eat 3 pieces of fruit, eat at least 1 salad, and read.
So for me, if I'm very tight and controlled in what I eat, which I usually am, I usually eat a lot of the same things all the time, every day, and it's super healthy. I have no problem with my weight. I have a lot of trouble when I'm outside of that zone. And this is the hard time of the year for it, like you pointed out, Asha, because there's so many exceptions. It's like, I want to have a good time with my wife. You know, she wants to go out and eat. We're going to go out and eat, right? Or if we have guests over, I'm not going to be like sitting there eating a salad, watching everybody else eat, you know, turkey or, you know, turkey's actually pretty good for you, but eating, you know, whatever, cookies and cakes and all this other stuff that we got for the holidays. And so it's just a challenge. You know, for years, like that's just been, you know, part of the fun of the holidays has been all the Christmas cookies and all the stuff that my mom makes. And so it is just, it's just a tough time of year. I think in general, if you can make it through flat, like without gaining 5 pounds, like I think it's like a major accomplishment.
I think you should do 40 days, not soft with me.
Okay. I'll go hard. I'll be 40
days hard.
I'll do 40 days really hard.
What are your goal markers?
How about we try to lose?
This is your daily checklist. What's your daily checklist? Like, what are your things? They don't have to be mine. Like the habits that you're going to do each day.
Well, I'll work out every day. That I can do. No problem. I eat salad every day anyway. I could do that. I'll eat. How about for me, like I don't eat processed carbs. For me, that is the biggest, that's the biggest source of weight gain.
Like what? Like what do you eat? Like chips? Like,
yeah. Well, anything like that is bad. If you eat chips, bread, bagels, you know what I mean? So anything that's processed, pizza, fries, that's all tough. Those are the biggest weight gainers for me. That's if I cheat on those, then it's like, the weight goes up.
I think mine's the wine.
Yeah. I don't drink much.
Yeah.
For that reason. I just, for weight reasons.
Yeah. I've been better, but then the holidays kind of threw me off.
For my wife, she could eat anything, but then now she's gotten like, she's 45. So as she's gotten older, it's harder. I'm sure I shouldn't say
that was the tipping point for me. Tell her that the glory days are over. I'm telling you, I was like, I can do whatever I want. And then I hit 45 and it was just over downhill.
I wish I had 45 years of eating whatever I wanted without gaining weight. That would have been amazing. That would have been amazing. That's like a Star Trek technology. Like if they could invent that, if Lieutenant Data could invent that and beam down, that would be fantastic for me. I would love to eat pizza and ice cream and all that stuff.
I know. I used to be able to, but now the muffin top is real.
MSW Media.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.